Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I think people have funny bones, and it is people can say funny things or they can do funny things. And if it's not there, it's not there. I don't think, I know it's quite fashionable to say anybody can dance and anybody can sing, but if you haven't got a decent singing voice in the first place, you're not going to start the Colosseum.
Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport and entertainment, who are here to share their wisdom and their use of humour. Humorology is the study of how humour can dramatically improve your business success and your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. My guest on this edition of the Humorology Podcast is a renowned medical doctor and the founder of the Premier Medical Group. Throughout his career, he has sat at the head of many boardrooms as chairman of companies such as Personal Injury Forum at Bupa, RTA Limited, and Curo Healthcare, just to name a few. In addition to leadership in the business boardroom, you can also find him as the chairman of Lancing College, fellow of the Woodard Corporation, a council member of Southwark Cathedral Development Trust, and the chairman of the English National Opera. In addition to his contributions to medicine and business, he is known for his funny bone, including performing as a stand-up while studying to be a doctor. His talks are captivating and comedy-ridden, leaving audiences and the likes of Tommy Steele and Sir Tim Rice cackling in his wake. The only thing more impressive than his list of titles and accomplishments are his glorious gifts for the game of golf. Dr. Harry Brunges, welcome to the Humorology Podcast.
I'm not sure I can follow that. They always say in show business, the hardest thing is to follow yourself, isn't it? For that glorious kickoff there. I'm all yours.
Oh, well, it's lovely to have you here, Harry. I'm really pleased you could take the time. Firstly, I'd like to take you back to the early years when you were growing up. You were born to the sound of song. Your father was the oldest of three brothers who trod the boards as the Singing Scott Brothers, a close harmony doo-wop group. Music was obviously everywhere, but was humour also valued in your family?
If you go back to that, I'm the fifth Harry Brunges who's had show business, has had comedy in the blood, and what's that lovely gag? It's a shame the comedy never reached my act. But my great-grandfather was principal flautist for the Scottish Symphony Orchestra. My grandfather was a pianist and played in the silent movies. My father then became a variety star with his two brothers and the Singing Scott Brothers. And they started in kilts and tartan jackets in Scotland, but the whole thing spread to England. And they ended up doing summer seasons, the big seasons like Blackpool and Bournemouth, Great Yarmouth. And then they did the Royal Variety Show in 1952 at the London Coliseum. So that links in nicely with me being, nearly a decade as chair at the London Coliseum. Then the reason they really stopped doing that was they were all married with young children, first of all. And then you mentioned Tommy Steele, who's a long-term family friend. But with the arrival of Tommy in 56 and Bill Haley in the Comets, my father and his two brothers thought that close-knit harmony stuff, Mills Brothers, Inkbox type stuff, wasn't going to sustain. And then they were going to go into Blackpool one summer in 57, 58 with George Formby, but then they decided against it. But if I just, before I let you back in, the bit which I thought was rather cheeky was a couple of years later, by which stage all three of them were now school teachers. They got a phone call from the London office about Sunday concerts at the Opera House Blackpool. And the stars were, every Sunday, a big American star like Lena Horne, Johnny Ray, Guy Mitchell, the guy who was in The Godfather, whose name escapes me, the crooner, come to me in a minute, the Deep River Boys. And rather cheekily, not having done anything on stage for 2 years at that level, they turned up to the Opera House and they rehearsed in the afternoon and they opened for Lena Horne and Guy Mitchell. And so that's one of our family anecdotes.
Wow, that's extraordinary. Well, I mean, obviously song was everywhere and music was everywhere. In those variety acts, was comedy also important? And did that... a sense of fun, a sense of humour pervade the family?
So they were three brothers, and when they were at their pomp, the ages were, I don't know, 26, 24, 22. And so there was a lot of sibling gags on the stage and a lot of messing about, a lot of lighthearted introductions, and then a lot of comedy songs, like a comedy version of a number called Donkey Serenade and things like that. So there was a stack of that, none of the three of them actually did us. They did lighthearted. They were good talkers. They were good spontaneous talkers. They never actually did the sort of naked 12-minute spot, you and the microphone. They never did that, you know.
So it was patter, a bit of patter in between.
Yeah, they taught me the whole patter and all the standard stuff. Yeah.
Well, you said they taught you the whole patter. I mean, so was the young Harry humorous?
I think I was. And then as then my father ended up as a school teacher in Lowestoft. Then he became a headmaster in Bedford in later years. But for about 10 years, when all the big shows came into Great Yarmouth, my father knew them all. And as a boy, I had the great thrill of standing at the side of the stage, watching Morecambe and Wise going on. Watching Bruce Forsyth going on. I was only 8, 9, or 10, but it was highly influential to stand there at these summer shows and to have all Lenny the Lion, who's a family friend, and, you know, watching them come on, Sandy Powell, you know, just the little skills which may get onto the ability, how important it is as an act to be able to walk on and walk off and look as if you know what you're doing. You know, it's most people. Audiences want people to do well, but they can smell if somebody has fear. And that walk on to the middle, you know, ladies and gentlemen, Harry Scott, and you walk out and you look as if you mean business. And so I was taught all that. I watched it. And then as the years went on, and as we may come on to, I worked with some of these stars. Sandy Powell in particular was very helpful.
And when you say helpful, because a lot of people who listen to this podcast around the world, you know, one of their main fears is speaking in public. And you've just touched on something I think that is already important. This walk on, people buy confidence. And as somebody who works in psychology, I'm interested, having done it myself, what is that thing that you could say to people, how do you walk on and give the audience a feeling that you are confident?
It'd be worth your while watching some of the old timers. If you watch Norman Wisdom make his entrance, you watch Frankie Howard make his entrance, I can think, and Doddy worked very fast when he came out, but he was a busy bee, but it was rehearsed within an inch of his life. You know, the hat, the big furry coat, the big tickling stick, And it looks as if it was all spontaneous, but it was out, stage left, tickle, stage right, tickle. How are you, missus? Bend forward, look to the side, all rehearsed. Norman Wisdom come out, pretend to fall. And Jackie, my wife, did a show with them. The pretending to fall bit and tripping up bit, it all looked spontaneous. It was rehearsed like a ballet. And it's remarkable. If you watch Morecambe Wise, there's only one live clipping of theirs, as far as I know, from the Fairfield Halls 50 years ago. That's right. And you watch them come out. Ernie goes first. He comes behind. They walk together. They walk over stage left, take a call. Walk over stage right, take a call. Then take a ball. Then they cross over. That all looks as if it's just very natural. It's beautiful stuff.
So one of the things you touch on there is actually the rehearsal of that. So it's actually very, very clear, you know, that when you come on, you own the stage. I spent 10 years working at the Comedy Store, and I always say to people, it's about putting everybody else at their ease. So they go, they've got this. They're in charge. And you talked about your father and his brothers being school teachers and headmasters and things. Is that the same thing, that walking in and taking charge?
So my father as a headmaster was, he wasn't a disciplinarian, but he had discipline. And he used to say the public speaking bit of school teaching is terribly important. You will remember when you're at school, there were teachers who could be 5 foot tall, but you wouldn't mess around with. And there would be teachers who were 6 foot six and you would mess around with. There was just something about the personality that they meant business. And so my father's confidence in public speaking, the school assemblies and all that sort of stuff, he just had it. And he relates lots of his life, as I do, to these very experiences you've had along the line.
Well, I think it's one of the best founding blocks. I mean, you went on to work as a GP before founding the Premier Medical Group. And obviously, then you sold your clinics and everything. As a successful businessman, do you think, on the back of what you just said, has humour actually helped with the whole business aspect?
I've done some pretty big negotiations. And when you're closing out on a multi-million pound deal, if anybody ever listens, you know, whoever listens to the podcast, if you've done that, I never know why that you've been negotiating due diligence for 9 months and yet you're still stuck in a big legal office at 4 a.m. in the morning, arguing the toss and signing it all the way. And then you end up arguing over trivia as you get nearer. I sometimes think it's a psychological thing that people don't want to sign or don't want to close, or the lawyers want to continue making money. But you go there before in the morning. And my technique, and I do it naturally, is to keep chucking in a bit of patter. It gets tense. And somebody will say something stupid, and I'll say, are you still available for pantomime? And I'll do something like that because it gets tense. And you've got to bring people back from the brink. And sometimes they get so tense, they're on the verge of either really losing their temper or making a fool of themselves. And I just do it naturally. That bit has been so much part of me now. It's preconceived. I don't do it.
Well, there's a very interesting social science study. I don't know if you've ever come across it, whereby in negotiation, which you just talked about, they found that when people negotiated straight, they didn't get as good a deal as when they used words at the end of the negotiation, which were, I'll also throw in my pet frog.
Yeah, they do. And
so what it does, I think it just lightens the mat and perhaps opens the door and humour opens that door, which is an interesting concept.
Well, I say things like, you know, if you stick another note on the end of this, you can spend a whole year at my house in Spain playing golf at Valderrama. And they go, no, we can't move the price, Dr. Brundage. I said, well, bang goes that year's golf, you know. And I listen, some of it, I can't remember. It just comes off the top of my head. It's like ad-libbing.
Oh, it is. But do you think that has a marked effect on why business people work better when they can ad-lib and they can play with the room, as it were.
Well, I always like to leave somebody with something. I also like to think we'd do a deal again. And maybe it's the insecurity of a comic. I'd like to think they like you a bit, that maybe when it's all over, you'd have a decent lunch or a dinner anyway. Because you never know when they come round on the roundabout of life again. So I'm not into that sort of Wall Street, Michael Douglas, bashing them into submission, you know, taking them for everything they've got.
No, I think that's, and it's an interesting thing that you, who have been a very, very successful businessman and you're chairman of all kinds of places, still value humour as the difference that makes a difference. And what you just said, well, I thought was very interesting. I still think people will do better business with people they like and they trust.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Is that crucial?
It's all about people, isn't it? You know, at the end of the day, people do business with people. You know, you don't do business with a balance sheet. You don't do business with a CRM platform. You don't do business with a back office payroll. At the end of the day, I had this just yesterday. Somebody was moaning, I won't say which bank it was, moaning about the bank. God, you can't trust them these days. And in fact, that's not fair on the bank, because the only reason you say that is because you've fallen out with the one person on the telephone. And because one person in these huge multinational banks doesn't serve you correctly, that then immediately accentuates to being the whole bank is rubbish. And so it's all of that, really.
Do you think that as a leader, it's you set the tone for everyone around you? Because you just talked about sort of one person on the phone. You know, that can ruin somebody's impression of a whole organization. How incumbent is it on a leader to lead with laughter, if you like, or lead with lightness?
Well, it could be that. But there are many ways to lead. I personally find with comedy and being lighthearted about it works. But the cult, the ethics, the values, which are, you know, fashionable words these days, the mission and vision comes from the top. It comes from the top, you know, and it's important not to abuse that power. This is probably not to do with your podcast, but with football clubs in particular, they spin round leaders at a great rate, because there is an underlying culture to most of our big, you know. Tottenham Hotspur, Arsenal, Spurs are different. And often when you put big personalities into these big institutionalized clubs, there's immediately a collision between the ethics and values of this new personality, both interacting with the long-standing culture of the club. And it doesn't sometimes work.
So what is the way through that then, in your opinion?
Oh, that's a different point. As a chair, there's nothing more important than you do than you hire a chief exec. When I've hired chief execs in the West End, I keep pointing because it's just over there, West End, or in education, chairing at Lansing, or in business, I must admit I spend a lot of time on those processes. You know, you only get one chance to make a first impression, and that appointment of a chief exec must be right.
So, and what are you looking for? How important is humour in that process? Do you have to, I mean, could you get a chief exec who was doer and didn't have a sense of humour? Or is it something that sways the balance?
Well, this is the value judgment. I undoubtedly work better with chief execs who can make me laugh. And of course, it's very sensible for them to laugh at my jokes as well. That goes a long way.
Well, yeah, but isn't that about getting rapport with people, isn't it? And if they can get rapport with you, presumably the undercurrent in your mind is, well, they'll be able to get rapport with the team and bring people with them rather than, you know, be an authoritarian.
Yeah, well, I just think there are some major people we've all know of in life who, if they could have had a lighthearted moment, I don't know, just off the top of my head. Let's take Gordon Brown. Well, I don't know why I'm mentioning him this morning, but Gordon Brown clear intellectual foundation, extremely bright, but a serious man and could be on the doer side of life. But on occasions later in later life, when I've seen him interviewed retrospectively or given comment on a current situation, he is funny, he is bright, but that never came out when he was leading the Labour Party or the country.
Talking about politicians, do you think that humour and or perceived humour and a charisma is now crucial for somebody to actually get there? Because we see what's happening at the moment. Boris Johnson, you know, got an 80-seat majority by being perceived as that. And now the perception is, which I don't think is true, is that Keir Starmer is a bit dour and is a bit straight. Do you think now the public are looking for charismatic, humorous leaders?
Well, you've fallen to one of my little after-dinner lines. When we had Boris one side and Keir the other, I said, you know, my view, leadership, you have to have swagger and substance. And when Boris was prime minister, I said, we have a prime minister full of swagger, but no substance. And we have a leader of the opposition who's full of substance and no swagger. And that's where I landed on it. And I can smell, because I like PMQs, I watch it if I can. He's doing his best, Keir, to get a bit more swagger. But going back to comedy, even though he's a barrister, He doesn't quite time the gags sometimes, and he lays them up that, you know, it's sometimes they're trailed too much, and he ruins it by over trailing the punchline. He doesn't naturally feel the journey to the punchline sometimes, and he's clearly been taught how to do it, and I bet he's in and out studios rehearsing all day long.
Well, that's really interesting, because you with your show business roots and show business background, do you think that comedy can be taught, or is it an instinct that is within people who hear the beats naturally and are able to do it?
You know the film Jerry Lewis, Funny Bones?
Yes.
Lovely line, you know, when he's trying to teach his son comedy and he says, son, some people say funny things, others do funny things. It breaks my heart to say it to you, but you can do neither. It's a lovely scene on the beach when he's, you know, his son is trying to follow his father. I think people have funny bones, and it is, people can say funny things or they can do funny things. And if it's not there, it's not there. I don't think, I know it's quite fashionable to say anybody can dance and anybody can sing. But if you haven't got a decent singing voice in the first place, you're not going to start the Colosseum. And the great dancers who come strictly, you know, the ones who've done well and won, they would still look pretty exposed coming out on stage at the Royal Ballet Company, you know, the Royal Opera House, I think. So I think you've got to have something there. We all have innate talents. You may be the greatest world canoeist, and we don't know it because you haven't done it. You may have an innate skill there, and you don't know it.
No,
you could probably make more money doing canoes than you could do the podcast. You may not know that, but this could be a directional moment for you.
Oh, well, I'm going to take that and give this
an
up act, and go canoeing.
Their business. Take that as an action.
No, it's interesting because when you were talking there, I was thinking we had William Hague on the podcast, who was brilliantly funny at PMQs. And Alistair Campbell, who we also had on the podcast, was said the only person they feared was William Hague because he was funny. But William Hague categorically on the record said Margaret Thatcher was not funny. She didn't get anything. No. And really just didn't get the gags and didn't have that grounding of hearing funny, feeling funny, or whatever is it. So is it just a gift given from God?
Well, William, I know William Hague because I sat on the, in my early days at E&O, I sat on the board with Fionn Hague. She was a fellow board member. So I spent time with him. He clearly is a natural comic, and he's a well-known after dinner speaker. And as you know, he became all the rage when he was a funny 14-year-old, wasn't he, at the conference? And he suddenly, no, he has comedy. I mean, he has timing. There's a lovely story about Margaret Thatcher, which Charles Moore gives about comedy. They wrote about her lack of knowledge or understanding of it. They wrote a piece. It's when the Labour Party, you know, they changed the mantra. They had a dove, didn't they? What's the Labour Party?
That's right. The logo.
The bird on it. So the scriptwriters 40 years ago wrote a whole piece for her, mimicking and plagiarising the dead parrot sketch from Monty Python. So it was all written out for her and she'd rehearsed it. But it said, I don't think this about the dead parrot's funny. I don't think it's funny. They said, oh, Prime Minister, will work. You just pause there, hold there, do the comparison with dead parrot. It will land. That is funny. She goes, well, if you say it, I'll go out and do it. And she's standing in the wings at the Bournemouth conference, again, still worried about the dead parrot. And then she said to the scriptwriters, this fellow Monty Python, is he one of us? She had no idea who Monty Python was. So Charles Moore dines out on that. Oh, this fellow Monty Python. Anyway, there you are.
Oh, we're going down that road. What makes you laugh, Harry? I see Max Wall on your wall behind you, so I'm presuming that he's one of them.
There he is. So after my early days with my father, then when I was at school, at the age of 14, I started work as a butler and redcoat. So I did 3 years as a redcoat, and I got into a thing which was very big business. I got into the redcoat show, which then I travelled around all the Mineheads and the Filies and the Bogners and the Clactons and did all the camps. So what made me laugh then, it was fabulous, really. I mean, there I was doing science O-levels and science A-levels and then seeing all this Easter holidays and summer holidays. I just loved the nonsense of the... I love what some of the corny old routines. And, of course, when you travelled with them, you knew their acts back to front because they were word perfect. They had a 14-minute routine and it was just like turning a record on. It was just... And then I loved the bits where it went wrong. But as I was watching all that, I did love Monty Python. I did love Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. And people often used to say, I'm a pianist. People used to say to me, who's the greatest pianist? And I'd say the greatest unsung pianist, in my view, is Dudley Moore. And the greatest unsung horn player is Roy Castle, because they were known for other things.
Yeah.
Although they were brilliant musicians, people don't quite remember them for being brilliant musicians, you know, whereas Dudley Moore could have spent his whole life playing at Ronnie Scott's, and Roy Castle could have sat in a pro band his whole life playing horn. He was fabulous. But when I was watching them, I loved all that on TV, but I got more seduced by watching these traditional musical comics from the side. And I never saw Max Miller, but I saw Trinder a lot. I saw Max, who I knew, Stax. And then other comics at the time, the young Jimmy Tarbuck, I saw lots of. A double act I worked with, you may or may not remember, called Hope and Keane, who I thought were very good at knockabout comedy. Sandy Powell, the comedian, I loved. Used to watch a lot of Bob Monkhouse. But I suppose my favourite was Max Wall. He had every trick in the book and every line in the book, every pause. A wonderful entrance on the stage. And he's had two routines. One was the tights when he did Professor Woloski. Then the other one when he just came on in a suit with a trilby. And it was just the pace of it. And a wonderful opening.
So you mentioned so many people there. I mean, they are all of a certain era. Is there anyone in more recent times that you think has held a candle to them?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, Billy Connolly was in a class of his own. Eddie Izzard does a most bizarre stand-up. I mean, he's got such intelligence. And he's brave because he sometimes disappears down a stream of consciousness, whereas most comics will disappear down somewhere and will want to close, you know, and say, the vicar said, you know, But Eddie will go down somewhere, and if it peters out, he doesn't bother.
I've known Eddie for so long, since he first started, and I would say there's a word I always say about Eddie is brave. He's extraordinarily brave, because he doesn't mind going down those rabbit holes, but he's got enough confidence to know that he can find his way out.
He's extremely good like that. The one who interests me, of course, is Peter Kay is an astonishing talent. But I compare him with Billy, who I only met once. You know, Billy did start as the archetypal Scotch comedian, dressing up in the outfit with the big banana boots on, and it was all very Scottish and things. But he moved away from that, and he moved first of all to England and then to the States, and then would stand up in a jeans and a t-shirt and talk about anything. You know, Peter Kay's enormous. I mean, he's going to make a fortune out of the O2 next year, and yet he hasn't. In a way, he's still on the Northern Bolton man, isn't he? You know, and I suppose he could just move away from that.
People who listen to this podcast are obviously we do get quite a lot of comics because I know them, but mainly it's people in business, who want to know what you're a great after dinner speaker. You do it. What do you think your advice to anybody who's standing up to speak should be? Is it, you know, only use humor if you're sure it will work, or allow the humor to come? What do you think that normal people, in inverted commas, who just have to get up and speak, what do you think that key nugget that you would give them is?
If you're not funny, and being funny, trying to be funny, terrifies you, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't, number one. If you've been asked to speak, first of all, be nice. If you're going to be funny, that's a bonus. If you can't do it, don't kill yourself. Don't try. And if you, I see so many people, I can see in these after dinner routines, they're getting into a gag I know, they're rushing for the punchline, they can't pace it. And I can see their faces drop when it doesn't land, and they think, don't do it. I mean, although I would love to, I don't try and play football for Tottenham Hotspur. You know, I can't do it. So don't, if you're not funny, don't do it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
If that's the first thing. Second thing is don't overstretch. If you're going out for the early time, don't try and do 25 minutes. Do 8 minutes. Don't, you know, 25 minutes, can I tell you, with a mic in your hand is a long time. And so do 8 minutes. Do 6 minutes and just make it a good 6 minutes. And one of my lines, another one, I've got loads of this stuff. You can get me talking about this all day long. Spontaneity is all about rehearsal. And rehearse and rehearse and rehearse. And have a very good start. Don't get up. that opening line, it sounds silly, but good evening, ladies and gentlemen. What a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invite. Just get that very clear. None of that is funny, but it looks as if you're confident.
And confidence sells, doesn't it, in any field?
Just get your start and have your finish. And have the finish. And the finish is either genuine, it's about you, or could be something to do with whatever sector you're in. Or if it's a nice story, there was a period when I was doing after dinner speaking when, in fact, it's gone out of fashion. You'd be picking on someone in the audience, you know. Thank you, sir. I was going to do an impression of an idiot tonight, but you've just beaten me to it, you know. And you could do all that stuff, but that's gone now. If you're going to do anything like that, it's self-deprecating. So, so I will stand up and say, what a great pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for tolerating me. Before I became chair of English National Opera, I was 6'6" with long brown hair. Now look what's happened. But nice stuff against yourself. I would do that.
So you talk about self-deprecation. Do you think it's important, not just on stage, but in life and in business, to be able to laugh at yourself?
Yeah, you have got to laugh at yourself. And if you laugh at yourself, then they like it. And actually, if you take the mickey out, everybody's there in boardrooms, it's all quite alpha. But if you say something about yourself, you know, being small or bald, whatever it is, you do that, that actually, they find that takes them off guard. That takes them off guard.
Do you find that that's more of a British thing? Because, I mean, having lived in America and seen it there, they seem less inclined to go the self-deprecation route. And do you have to adjust depending on who the audience is?
Yeah. I mean, I've done a lot of business in Hong Kong as well and the States. The States is all speak and all algorithms. And we must close out here before the fall, and they're all talking like that. And Hong Kong, of course, it's all very charming, extremely graceful, exchanging cards. And in fact, if you come in with a comedy, they don't like it because they don't understand it. You certainly can't do British comedy there. American comedy is very different as well. And it's horses. I wouldn't go out. I mean, I've done a lot of after dinner speeches in Hong Kong. I wouldn't go out to the Hong Kong Football Club and do my old material from Great Yarmouth. it'd be foolish.
Well, that takes me to another place, because what you're describing to me is the importance of listening to a room.
Well, you get me onto another one of my stories. I qualified as a medic in 1980. I was 5 years a junior surgeon between Guy's Hospital and the Royal Sussex County Hospital. And then I spent 5 or 6 years as a general practitioner. And then I used to train younger general practitioners coming through. And I used to say, well, let me do this. Let's say you're a medical student. Now, there's another career for you. I would say to you, Paul, as a doctor, what's the most important thing you do with a patient? What do you think the answer is?
Listen to them?
Correct. Now, they all get that wrong, junior doctors. They all say, make a diagnosis. They all say, do a blood test. They all say, examination. And I say, just listen to them. Can I tell you, if you listen, you'll have the diagnosis even before they're on the couch. And just listen to them.
I'm slightly cheating here because I spent 2.5 years training doctors in communication at Guy's, King's and St. Thomas's. So I kind of get it. But one of the things I found with doctors is that the hardest thing to teach them was to listen and to actually be in the room with people. The amount of people I found who were looking at their laptop or their computer rather than at the patient was remarkable to me.
And what I used to do in those days, if somebody came in with an esoteric rare illness, I would send them off to the professor whose faculty, whose discipline that was. And I used to say, look, you're going to go and see Professor Smith, brain the size of a planet. Trust me, it's the right person to see. But having said that, once you've seen him, come back and see me and I'll translate for you. You know, I'll explain what he was talking about, because they go straight into speech. But the condition you have, Mrs. Johnson, the osmotic transfer of the O2 molecule across the alveoli membrane is competing with the actual CO2 componency on the hemoglobin. And they just go into that. And of course, and people nod away, you know, because they think they're in front of some, but they come out even more confused and not satisfied.
I saw that happen so many times. And what doctors don't realise is that people go into altered states when they're in front of a doctor, yeah, or a medical professional. So they get more confused. And the first thing they hear that they can latch onto is the thing that they believe is true. You know, and a doctor could say something like, oh, yes, people who've had your condition, some only lived 6 months, but you're young, healthy and fit. But they will just hear 6 months, come out and go, I've got 6 months to live. And it's very, very, it's how you say it. It's the, well, it's how, it's like comedy, isn't it? It's how you deliver it.
You can talk to them for an hour. The only word they'll remember is cancer. And so you've got to be, again, you've got to use that. And again, over the years, having been on stage, having had a very open family relationship, having done all that red coat work and holiday camp stuff, and then having been on, you know, on the theatre tour, I just learned lots of things to say and saying the right things at the right time.
It's instinct.
But you talk about coming on stage, you know, when I used to take my entrance, ladies and gentlemen, and I'd come out, do all that. It's the same used to come and see me in Harley Street. I don't care who it was, whether it was Lord Haw-Haw or don't be absolutely consistent, treat everybody exactly the same. Get up, meet them at the door, shake their hand, sit them down. And I hope I didn't keep you waiting. Now, how can I help you today? And you know, the word help's important, for example. I just tell them, say help, because they are there for help.
Yes.
And again, to me, that was a bit of an act, really. You know, up, next patient, press the bell, go and meet them. If I was running fluently and not tight on the time, it didn't always work because of the pressure of patients. I'd actually go and pick them in out of the waiting room, go and get them.
Brilliant. Because it's an entrance, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's,
yeah,
and already you're creating rapport between, yeah, you and yourself. And you just said it earlier on, you never get a second chance to make a first impression.
No, I know.
And that's, you've just shown why that's so important. And I thank you for that. If I asked you to write a business case for humour, Harry, what would you include in it?
If there was to be humour in the workplace, I think you would bring, this sounds rather trite, but you would bring happiness. And I think people would be happier. It's not a struggle to come to work. People know I'm running these things. There's no need to keep reinforcing you're the boss. And I like to be approachable. So I think humour and happiness are important core things to any institution, whether it's a business or a school or an institution. Let's take London Coliseum. I've been there best part of a decade. I have a great relationship with the chief exec. I also have a great relationship with Mick on the stage door. I also have a great relationship with Mohammed, who's in charge of security. And they're all very charming to me. We have lovely exchanges. I found out what they like to talk about. And Mohammed likes to talk about London. Mick likes to talk about Tottenham Hotspur. And it just makes me very, very happy. And sometimes I may need something done very quickly. I know because I'm close to Mick on stage, I can phone him. And no problem, doctor. Leave it with me. I'll get it sorted. And it just works.
That's really interesting from a man who, you know, is chair at the ENNO and all those things, that you are still aware that it's all about the relationships, isn't it? And there was a really interesting study in America that concluded that 85% of all your success in life is down to the quality of your relationships. And I think when you're talking to Mohammed or whoever, you are using humour and lightness of touch, are you not?
Yeah. I've had a nice line. I won't say who gave it to me. It's a national figure said this. We're involved in this bun fight at E&O. And this national figure put his arm around my shoulder and he said, Harry, I do enjoy these moments where you seamlessly transfer from being Norman Wisdom to James Cagney. And most of the time, I'm quite happy to mess about. But, you know, if there's an issue, I'll take control of it and I'll run with it, as I am with the E&O right now.
Well, and I wish you every success with that. And we will encourage everybody who listens to the Humorology podcast to actually support your cause at the E&O make sure that they sign the petition. I've heard you say that there's a growing understanding of the relationship and potential of the arts to promote health, prevent disease and accelerate rehabilitation from illness. Does that include humour aiding resilience in that sense?
I often say people used to get better long before doctors were invented. And I'll do a simple thing for you. Let's do heart disease. You may genetically be predisposed to heart disease, and that's the risk of life. You know, I often say it's important to choose your parents wisely. On top of that, what could make your heart disease worse? Smoking, being overweight, lack of exercise, poor sleep, stress. So these are very simple lifestyle factors. Now, there's lots of theories on obesity. I mean, it's against infantry predisposed to. All of us have been guilty for comfort eating. You know, when we're not feeling happy, and you then will go for the second bacon sandwich, or you'll clear the cheesecake in the fridge. We've all been guilty when you've had a bad week of opening that bottle of wine and finishing it. But if you were happy, you may not have eaten to excess, you may not have drunk to success. And if you can just get some, even however bad the situation is, if you can get some comedy out of it, then you've got to find a way of coping. So it's, if there is happiness and comedy, I think it reduces the stress levels. There's loads of work being done on this. There's loads and loads of papers to do with, the fashionable expression is called social prescribing. You know, when you bring lifestyle factors into people's lives. And a lot of work has been done to see if you can actually cut down dependency on your doctor, dependency on the hospital, dependency on drugs by actually correcting some of your lifestyle factors.
Yeah, well, I think Dr. Tim Sharp of the Australia's Happiness Institute said something about humour being the core component in resiliency. And one reason for that is that it's about seeing things from a different perspective. And something that's something that all the best comedians do, isn't it?
Yes. But the juxtaposition of that, the comedians hopefully will make you happy because they make you laugh and they relax you. But the amount of comics I've met, they're quite uptight.
Well, yes. Yeah. Well, but the happiest, most successful people don't just stop at one way of looking at things, is it, or a situation. They explore other ways, which is using that component. By the way, both of us have known a lot of comics, and I know what you're saying.
And they can be tricksy, can't they? And I've never been involved in more tension when you've got five comics on the same show. I mean, there used to be a TV series called The Comedians years ago, and these are six to go out on the road. My God, the fight for nicking time, pinching each other's material, who went first, who went last, and all the rest of it. And unbelievable, really.
It was four acts and a compere every night at the Comedy Store, two shows a night. So I'm very aware of that one. But I love all of them dearly because I still think that they are doing the hardest job in the world. And having been around it, I mean, if you think about it, what comedy is, and you do it and I've done it, what you're doing is making people do an involuntary act, you know, and that's got to be the hardest thing. And taking them on that journey and then giving them that huge dopamine hit that makes them feel great.
I can tell you a current story. At E&O, during the crisis, we thought, how else can we help? So one of the problems of long COVID is they don't breathe very well. They've got respiratory complications. They've got these inflammatory changes on the internal anatomy of the lungs. So we can't reverse inflammatory changes, but most people don't breathe correctly. So when they were breathing with these inflamed lungs, they were starting to affect their oxygen saturation. So we've got our singers that actually show them how to breathe better using the diaphragm, using the upper muscles here, lifting the thorax. And it's proved. So therefore, the underlying disease is that's still there, but their ability to maximize their capacity on their lungs has improved. So they're feeling better, systemically feeling better. They're feeling stronger and better oxygenated. So we've now got, we call it ENO Breathe, and we have 2,000 patients on the project around the country with 85 NHS trusts. We then did a trial in 2021 with Imperial College, and it's proved to be so successful it was published in The Lancet.
Oh my gosh.
So it's hugely successful. So there is the art, and one of the techniques of the arts, i.e. singing, using your lungs. It's probably a variation of physiotherapy, really. But we haven't, it's cost the NHS nothing. It's meant less appointments to the GP. It's meant less hospitalizations. And that is just helping people maximize on what they have already.
I will look up ENO Breathe and we will tell everybody about it.
It's all on our website. All the years I was a doctor, I never published in The Lancet. Now I'm chairman of an opera company. I've published in The Lancet. It's a wacko juxtaposition of that.
Oh, that's wonderful. Harry, we've reached the time in the show which where we like to go for quick fire questions.
Quick fire questions.
Harry, who is the funniest business person that you've met? And I should say that Arlene Phillips named you as the funniest business person that she'd met. So who would you give that mantle to?
There was, who's remained a friend, a chap who used to run the RAC called Eddie Ryan. He could make me laugh because he had Liverpudlian humour. So that's what has come. So Eddie will be very pleased with the name check. He's retired now, but he had Liverpudlian lines.
Why is it that people from Liverpool, people from Glasgow have that rhythm, have that comedy?
I think they're tough cities. My parents were from Glasgow. Liverpool, I mean, you shouldn't just focus on the Beatles. You've got to go all the way back to Arthur Askey and Frankie Vaughan. There have been loads of them have come from Liverpool. And bringing you right up to date with John Bishop, you know, and Jimmy Tarbuck on the way. Lots of them.
So out of adversity comes humour, do you think? Yeah. My mother's from the East End of Glasgow as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I've done one quick fire and I've distracted you. What's the next one?
No. What book makes you laugh?
What book makes me laugh? Adam Kay's written books on medicine, and I'm just slightly irritated that I should have done those. So Adam Kay's books are funny, but I'm rather irritated I didn't write them first. I'm not sure that's the right answer to that.
No, but that's
my answer, I think.
Oh, no, it's good. What film makes you laugh?
A film I watch repeatedly, time which I just, if I'm on a flight and there's not, or if it happens to be on TV, it's not a question makes me, well, it does make me laugh because I enjoy it so much, which I know it's not original, but I adore Casablanca. I know every scene of Casablanca back to front. I like Funny Bones, which is why I mentioned it to you. There's a lot of showbiz and shtick in that. What makes me laugh? I love some of the scenes in Scent of a Woman with Al Pacino.
Oh, yeah. He is really funny in that, isn't he?
I've got every Marx Brothers movie going. I love some of the very old Road 2 films with Bob Hope and Bing Crosby. I love some of the stuff with Billy Crystal. His film. I saw a bit of what's it called? Was it Blazing Saddles? What was the film called 30 years ago?
No, it's not the Blazing Saddles.
City Slickers.
City Slickers, yeah.
City Slickers. And there's a scene where he's dressed up as a cavalryman in it with the two sidekicks, and there's the Indian drums. and they're going dum 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 dum. This is only I only heard this line on Saturday, and the sidekick says, "I don't like the sound of those drums," and Billy Crystal says, "It's not the regular drummer."
That's a real showbiz line.
Great showbiz and shtick, you know. And he did another film I like, which makes me laugh, called Mr. Saturday Night, about
this
comic who, was tricksy, fell out of people, didn't behave himself, then became unemployable, then ended up, you know, doing old people's homes and stuff. And again, I know lots of comics like that who had the moment, but they were just so tricky.
I'm going to take a shift to the other side briefly now and ask you, what's not funny?
Well, I think everything has the potential to be funny. It's what was it? Was it Lord Sorbonne? You know, nothing matters very much and few things matter at all. And if you can carry that mantra with you, I mean, I find most things have not, I mean, board meetings, there's so much comedy and goes on within. In the rehearsal room, it's serious. I can see little bits going on, people's unhappiness, frustration. I mean, some of the horrendous things. And there's nothing funny about the Ukrainian war, is there? You know, nothing at all.
But the funny thing is that we had John Sweeney, who is reporting from there and who's based there now. And he said that the thing is that... you do find funny things within that, because that's a survival mechanism.
It's like a medicine. I mean, I was the duty doctor the night of the Grand Hotel bomb blast back in 1984, and I looked after all those famous politicians. You know, there is a sort of secret comedy between doctors, even in moments like that, really. And but when what you don't want of any of the comedy which sometimes naturally appears, you don't want it to sound unkind, because it's not meant to be like that.
No, and I think, but it's sometimes just a coping mechanism, isn't it? Yeah. You know, they talk about gallows humour. It has to be there as a release.
Yeah.
But everything is potentially funny if it's done with the right heart. Is that where you would go?
Yeah, well, see, it was in, the bomb was 84, and in 1997, 33 years later, I was president of the Sussex Medical Society, and I asked Norman Tebbit to come and speak. And that was his first visit back. And I introduced him, and he came out, and he goes, "Thank you, Harry." And again, he had presence about him. And he says, "I trust the night will be less eventful than my last visit to Brighton." It's a great opening line. And again, he walked out well. People were pleased to see him back in Brighton. He had rehearsed that line and it landed. And I just thought it was extremely professional.
Yeah, and classy, really. It's a classy line, thing. What word makes you laugh, Harry?
Well, three words are currently making me laugh and cry, and that's the Arts Council England. make me cry and laugh in equal measure. A word. Well, I let me do that. Max Wall had a few of these. You know, he used to, that voice, splendid, and he had that lovely way of speaking. And he used to take the mickey out of the toss, you know. And he used to say to people, you know, "Did you enjoy my act?" Go, "Oh, absolutely capital." And he had lots of those things. That was all from his comedy routine.
What a genius. What a genius. And the sound, because I was going to ask you what sound makes you laugh, but it may be the sound of Max Wall's delivery.
And good evening. You know, and he had this wonderful voice. That opening was, "Good evening, the name's Max Wall. I'm one of the great walls of China. My father was a brick," you know, and I heard that night after night. "Good evening, Max Wall here. I'm one of the great walls of China. My father was a brick." And I don't know what is funny about "my father is a brick," but it got a laugh every night.
Would you rather be considered clever or funny?
That's going to be a very arrogant answer. I'm very happy to be considered both, actually.
Well, I'll take that from you. But by the way, I always say that actually, in order to be funny, you have to be clever. I've very rarely met any comedian who isn't very sharp of mind.
I mean, there's certainly a different intellectual level. I mean, if you take Jonathan Miller, who I knew well in his last few years, a different intellectual level. But what they do have, all of them, depending on where they are on the sort of intelligence spectrum, they have great awareness, a great cunning, a great sense. They all have that in common, really. And all of them, they all have one thing. Whether you're a Northern Club comic or whether you're Peter Ustinov, they all had timing. They all had timing, all of them. And they just got it right. Okay. I mean, there's a big difference between Peter Ustinov and all those acts on the comedians. But, you know, if you're going to go and see those comedians, they did time perfectly.
It's the one thing that you can't actually get. You either have it, you either hear it, and it's there.
You know that Stephen Fry line? Did I try it on you?
No.
You asked me, what is the success of comedy, OT?
Okay. What is the success of time. Comedy? Well, that takes us nicely to the last question on the Humorology podcast, and that's Desert Island Gags. You've known hundreds of gags over the years. You can only take one joke with you to a desert island. Yeah. What would that be?
Gosh, off the top of my head. I like the one about the two priests in the graveyard, and one priest says, the other says, Father says, that there's a burst of thunder, a flash of lightning, and the good Lord himself, Jesus Christ, suddenly appeared on that very tombstone, right there in front of you. What would you do? And the other priest says, I'd look busy.
Oh, I never heard that gag. That is a great gag and a perfect way.
I can do hundreds of them. I love the Maxwell gag. I used to say, this is an old gag, but he used to land it so well. And he says, last night I nearly lost my lovely lady wife. Pause, look at the audience. What a card game that was.
That is absolutely brilliant. And you've been a wonderful guest. Thank you for the lightness. Thank you for the laughter. Harry Brunges, thank you very much for being a guest.
I'm still available for pantomime if anybody out there listening.
The Humorology podcast was hosted by Paul Barros. Produced by David Rose. Music by Steve Hayworth. Creative direction by Les Hughes. And additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.